Welcome to this podcast today, where we're delighted to have with us Dr. Hyman Patterson, an expert in ALS. And we're going to just go through some questions with her and get her perspective on all of her years of experience in treating patients with this disorder. So, welcome, Dr. Hyman Patterson.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about diagnosis and treatment of ALS and some of the important factors to consider.
Certainly. Well, let's start off with thinking about ALS, as I think we know it's a heterogeneous disease. It can manifest in many ways. Tell us a little bit about the manifestations of ALS that a clinician might see who encounters a patient.
I think the key feature is progressive weakness that's painless and that's associated on examination with evidence of what we call lower motor neuron, which is the anterior horn cell damage, as well as corticospinal tract damage. So upper and lower motor neuron. And with lower motor neuron problems, you'll get thinning of the muscles, atrophy, fasciculations, along with the weakness. And typically, you would lose reflexes. But in someone with ALS, where there's also involvement of the corticospinal tracts or upper motor neuron, you'll get hyperreflexia. And then that lack of sensory changes or any other neurologic findings at the time. And I think it's really important, progressive, painless weakness. One of the problems is, for instance, if it's an arm, people will get an MRI. But the average age of people with ALS is probably 50s to 70s, although it can be from 20, 18, we have juvenile ALS, to 90. But the average age is in that middle age category where a lot of people have arthritis of their neck or their lumbar spine, and you get an MRI, and I like to say there's some minor changes, and before you know it, they're in the orthopedist office. And but we need to think of ALS if we see painless weakness. And ALS is heterogeneous. I'm talking about limb onset mainly, but of course, 20% of people will present with speech and swallowing problems. About 80% will present with limb weakness. And depending on whose statistics you read, it may be anywhere from 40% would be arm, 40% leg. It'll vary, but typically it can be one arm or one leg and then spread from there, and that progression over time. And so the presentation is heterogeneous, and the progression can be heterogeneous. While we talk about a 2 to 5 year survival, I always like to point out to people that what you read in the books isn't always what you see, and that 20% of people will be more slowly progressive and live longer than 5 years. There is some other sort of differences. Some there are non-motor symptoms that can surface over time, and these primarily involve the cognitive domains. So you can see, 40 to 50% of people with ALS will have minor cognitive problems if you do formal testing that don't really much impact things. But up to 15% of people will have frontotemporal type of dementia or a dementia and have problems in executive dysfunction, and maybe even some behavioral changes of apathy. And of course, you can have depression and anxiety, but also pseudobulbar affect with ALS. And these are sort of non-motor things. Pseudobulbar affect is really that emotional ability where you laugh or cry too easily or you can't control it. And what isn't recognized as much as should be is the autonomic involvement. So you can get some GI dysmotility, orthostasis, bladder symptoms, and up to maybe 5% of people can have some sensory disturbances. And another thing that's maybe not so recognized is the hypermetabolic state that people can be in, so there'll be weight loss. And in fact, that's really important for progression because we know that BMI correlates with survival. The higher the BMI, the better folks do. And finally, you can get some sleep disorders. So there are these other symptoms, but the core feature that makes you think of ALS is progressive weakness that's painless. And on exam, the association of upper and lower motor neuron findings.
Once
Sure.
you detect that there has been a progression of weakness that has been painless, and you are thinking about the diagnosis, and you do your physical exam and find manifestations suggestive of that, what other testing or what is the first test you reach for to kind of get that diagnosis established?
Well, it's actually twofold. One is to look at the motor nervous system, and that would be an EMG nerve conduction. I want to look at the nerve conductions to make sure that there's no other peripheral neuropathy or motor neuropathy, or even something called motor neuropathy with conduction block mimicking what could be ALS. And the needle part of the study, which we call the EMG, is going to look for evidence of lower motor neuron involvement. And I'm going to look to make sure that they're well, look for diffuse involvement. That is, when the needle is in multiple different muscles, there's damage that can't be explained by one pinched nerve or one peripheral nerve lesion. So I'm going to do that. Nowadays, I probably will also order a neurofilament light chain, which we know can be elevated in people with ALS. It's not specific to ALS by any means. Suggests a neurodegenerative disease process like ALS, and the higher the level, it can give me some notion of how fast that person might progress. I'm also going to do some ordering of tests to make sure that there's nothing else that could be causing the damage. And that's going to be imaging studies and blood work that's directed at mimickers of ALS. And then when I see all that data, I'm going to put it together in to formulate whether or not, yes, this is ALS, or no, this is something that's mimicking ALS and perhaps has a different strategy for treatment or other interventions. You know, I also, once I diagnose ALS, am going to get genetic testing if somebody has ALS. And I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about treatments and why it's so important to get the genetic testing in addition to knowing about risk to other family members as well as treatment strategies.
Yes, let's go ahead to that right now. So yeah, let us know the various the benefits of diagnosing early for the patient's benefit and for the family. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, certainly early diagnosis is critical when the drugs that we have to treat the disease slow progression. So it makes sense the earlier in the disease course that we start them, the more effect that we can have. In addition, we also want to look at the genetic changes because we now have drugs that are directed at some of the genetic abnormalities. About 10% of ALS is familial. And in the familial variants, about 20% of that 10% is caused by a mutation in the gene SOD1. We now have a treatment for SOD1 mutations called tofersen, and this has been shown to slow the disease down. And excitingly, there's even been some reports of improvement. Again, it makes sense to get it started as early as possible. We also are working on treatments directed at other genetic forms. And so we want to know as soon as possible if somebody has one of these genetic forms and if there are some trials around that they could participate in. In addition, that, you know, we're off talking about the genetics, But in addition, there's ramifications for other family members, and we want to be able to educate folks on the implications of genetic disease and help with genetic counseling and also prevention if we can, where the community is now looking at, are there things that you can do to reduce the risk of developing ALS if you're at risk? And should you be followed in a clinical setting? The other reason that it's so important to diagnose early is really to mitigate some of the information that jumps around and the anxiety. Once you have a diagnosis, you can go on and focus on what we're going to do to manage the disease and what direct treatments we have, and also people to participate in clinical trials of new drugs that might help. So first, symptom management is critical and supportive care. And this is done in a multidisciplinary setting. And we have tools at our disposal that include things like non-invasive ventilation and survival than anything else that we have right now. And certainly is direct can prolong survival and certainly improve the quality of life and even has been shown to improve cognition. So that multidisciplinary care also gives a place for people to talk about what's going on and to help manage the symptoms as they come up, the progressive weakness. What can we do to maintain your quality of life and maintain hope? Hope is so important. The second issue is that I want to educate folks about the disease as soon as possible so that I can take some of the fear of the diagnosis away. And by talking about the what to ex talking about the fact that some there are treatments that slow the disease down, that there's lots of clinical trials going on, and that not everyone is going to be in that cookie cutter of 2 to 5 years survival, that our job is to put you in that 20% that lives longer than 5 years, and to go about talking about how we're going to do that. And then the third thing is giving people the opportunity to participate in clinical research, clinical trials that will help inform us about the disease and perhaps find new treatments. All of this makes it critical that we diagnose early, not to mention the fact that you take away the anxiety about what the hell is going on for people. What's going on? What's happening to me? And when you consider that the average time to diagnosis is 12 to 14 months, we have to do better. We have to do better. We need people being referred in when they first have the symptoms, and we can really manage the disease early and make a bigger difference.
Thank you so much. That was very insightful. Can you give us more insight just on the evolution of therapy? And in particular, can you talk a little bit more about Edaravone and Tofersen as far as how they work? You mentioned it before, but how they work and
Sure.
how effective they are in terms of their clinical trial profiles.
Sure. We now, have actually, it depends on how you look at it. We have three drugs approved for the disease and a fourth drug called Nudexta for the emotional lability. So the two drugs for sporadic ALS that we have are first riluzole. Riluzole was the first on the block, and it's been around now for 25 years. And riluzole, it was actually approved in 1995, and it's been shown to reduce glutamate excitotoxicity. One of the theories about the progression of ALS is that there's too much of this amino acid glutamate in the brain, And while glutamate is needed for nerve cells to talk to each other, an increase in the amount of glutamate is actually toxic or damages the nerves. And so the initial thought was that riluzole would reduce the amount of glutamate in the brain, and that's how it worked. In addition, now there's some evidence that it may also reduce the nerve excitability. And there have been several trials or reports. The initial one back in 1994, 155 people were on riluzole versus 158 placebo. And what they found was there was a survival advantage on 100 milligrams a day, and the dosing has become 50 twice a day. There have been several other sort of studies and real-world data, but probably the best review was the Cochrane review in 2009 that looked at four trials in more than 1,500 people treated. And it was clear from that review that riluzole at 100 milligrams a day certainly prolonged the median survival, but by a modest amount, around 3 months. And it's well tolerated. And the most common side effects that we have to look for is really elevated liver enzymes, although sometimes people do feel sedated and, can be tired on it or get some GI problems with it. So liver monitoring is needed. Now, more recently, of course, back in 2017, we had the approval of edaravone. And it was originally IV, but then in 2022, there was the approval of an oral version. So that was certainly advantageous. And the way edaravone or Radicava works is probably as a free radical scavenger. Another mechanism that certainly plays a role in the nerve degeneration or the motor neuron degeneration in ALS is oxidative stress and mitochondrial dysfunction. And edaravone acts as a free radical scavenger to reduce oxidative stress. It probably scavenges hydroxyl radicals and peroxynitrate, both of which contribute. And so that's how it's thought to work, is to protect neurons from this oxidative stress. And in the original study that showed efficacy was what's called the 19 study. And that showed a 33% reduction in the decline of the ALS-FRS, that functional rating score that we use in clinical trials. It appears that from subsequent studies, real world data, and even a more recent trial called the ADORE trial, that the benefits may clearly be in people with the earliest and most definite disease, although I suspect that the jury is kind of still out on this. But recently, with a different formulation, although it was oral edaravone, the ADORE study did not reproduce the effect, but their entry criteria were different and did not include, included, but it was more wide in terms of the distribution of severity and duration. So it seems like the earlier the disease, the better the effect of edaravone. But as I said, we'll be learning more, but it is approved and something that is in our arsenal to use. But the way tofersen works is we know that with a mutation in the SOD1 gene, what happens is that the SOD1 protein takes on a toxic gain of function. It causes damage and actually increases free radical damage. We also know that in animal models, if you knock out SOD1, the animals do okay. So the theory was, if we knock down the production of SOD1, that may mitigate disease. And it was shown first in animal models that blocking the production of SOD using what's called an antisense oligonucleotide that blocks the RNA from making SOD1 that the animals survived longer. And we then developed tofersen, which blocked SOD1 in people. And what was shown in the original trial was that even without any clinical effect, there was a trend towards some improvement in the rate of decline. But with what was really drove approval was the fact that that neurofilament light chain we talked about before declined, showing that the amount of neurodegeneration or motor neuron damage was reduced, and the SOD1 levels also dropped, showing that there was actually an effect of the drug. While tofersen was approved based on that, and the open label that continued even while the approval was going on, then the true effect of the drug on the rate of progression was demonstrated, and in fact, it also slowed the functional decline. There's evidence of, survival, and as I said, anecdotal evidence now in some reports of actual improvement for some folks. And the question becomes, and again, we get back to genetics, should this be used in people who carry the SOD1 mutation but don't show any evidence of disease? And this is going to be sort of a discussion, but you have to remember the downside. What are the reasons not to do that? Well, one reason is that not everybody who carries the mutation will actually manifest the disease. So we the penetrance, we don't fully know the penetrance yet. The second reason is it's not benign. It's a monthly injection intrathecally of this antisense oligo at this point. And there's been radiculitis, and inflammation has been one of the adverse events, albeit rare, but do no harm should be one of the first things we think of. So there's a huge effort now to understand asymptomatic gene carriers and when are they phenotypically expressing, when has penetrance occurred, so that we can implement treatments like tofersen as early as possible. So, exciting. And there are other gene therapies in development very aggressively that are actually being personalized to the gene mutation. And so we're very hopeful about that. But what you're hearing, Monica, and what again is you asked me about heterogeneity before. You can see that first we have the drugs for sporadic ALS actually directed at two different mechanisms. One is excitotoxicity, and one is oxidative stress. And there are actually many different mechanisms that have been implicated in ALS, and that makes it very difficult to target the disease. Again, another evidence of heterogeneity, because in any individual, one of these mechanisms, these multiple mechanisms, may be operating and driving disease. And until we have biomarkers that sort of identify which mechanism is driving an individual's disease and helps us stratify to treatment that are appropriate, that's when we're really going to make progress, I think. But we're learning about all these mechanisms, I always like to say, gene by gene. And so even the genetic underpinning of ALS, and there's now been 30 to 40 genes identified, are really highlighting the pathways important to motor neuron biology that, when damaged, can result in the phenotype of ALS. That, I always liken it to a stomach ache. I have a stomach ache. It might be a tumor. It might be an ulcer. It might be reflux. I have what looks like ALS, or what is diagnosed as ALS, but what's driving that disease could be any one of those 40 genetic defects or some other mechanism. And there's all these different mechanisms underlying the disease. And understanding that heterogeneity is going to help us make leaps and bounds in terms of treatment, understanding how to use biomarkers to stratify for clinical trials. Again, really important for participation in clinical research when a person is diagnosed with ALS, so we can learn more about this. I'm sorry if I went on a
No,
tr
you are great. I think that's perfect. I think you touched on my last question, which is going to be what you're excited about, but you really included that. Dr. Hyman Patterson, thank you so much for being on this interview today. We really appreciate your insights, everything from how the disease manifests, what clinicians should see and suspect it could be ALS, how they might go about establishing the diagnosis, reassuring or giving the diagnosis to the patient and their caregiver, giving them hope. And then, of course, importantly, for clinicians to understand that there are several FDA-approved agents that are available in the arsenal to be used. And of course, the hope for the future in newer therapies that are being involved in clinical trials. And of course, your certain pearl about encouraging patients to be involved in those clinical trials. So again, thank you for your time, and we really appreciate you sharing your infinite wisdom with us.